Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 15th of July 2012. My name's TRP Watson, and this week I'm joined by Phil from the West End Whingers, Rev Stan, Web Cowgirl, Nick from Partially Obstructed View, Gareth James, and Johnny Fox. We're now going to talk about Time on of Athens, which is in preview at the Olivier Theatre, part of the National, and is directed by Nicholas Heitner and stars Simon Russell Beale as the titular Timon or Timon. I think they all say Timon in the play, but apparently it's supposed to be Timon. And also has people like Hilton McRae as a philosopher, Epimantus, and Kieran McMenamin as Alcibiades, and Deborah Findlay as Flavia, who has been gender transferred from the normal Flavian. I think it's Flavius or Flavian, who is the Timon's servant. For people who don't know the play, this is about a rich man called Timon who is very generous with his money. He gives it away to all sorts of hangers-on and flatterers, and lives a happy life until the money completely runs out, at which point he finds himself abandoned by all his so-called friends and living on a scrap heap. In this play, it's a sort of derelict building site, I think, he ends up living on. Now, he finds wealth accidentally, and really just dies. is more or less the play. It's a rather odd play. I've only seen it a couple of times before this one, and I don't really feel that I know it well enough. This production sets it very much in modern times. We got a lot of bankers and the Alcibiades rebels are all sort of Occupy movement. We the stage when we first see it as we come into the theatre is full of the pop-up tents that you will see outside St Paul's or on Wall Street in the last year or so. But it's a rather effective piece. You've got a nice the design by Tim Hakeley is a rather effective piece, I thought. A nice use of the revolve and the inside scenes. They've got a nice big crowd of people. It's enormous. It's one of the things the National can do very well is just put a lot of people on the stage. So you've got a lot of supernumeraries who don't actually do a lot, but just sort of stand there and provide crowds. And I thought it was a nicely conceived piece. It works particularly well, this the whole thing of the updating. I thought that worked really rather well. But at the same time, there was a sort of a rather disturbing feeling that I had that I really didn't sympathise with Timon's plight at all. And I'm not sure if it's the play or whether this production just exacerbated that feeling that the man is surrounded by flatterers and by people who obviously don't care about him, apart from his servants who clearly love him. But the main people behind it, they don't care. They're just milking him for as much as they can, and you just end up not caring about him and not liking him particularly. I mean, yes, he loses all his money, but I didn't care in the end. You know, in some way, there's part of me that said, well, he just should have managed his money better. He deserved it. And I feel like an appalling Tory. Phil, what did you think about this?
Well, I agree with that, pretty much most of what you said. I'd never seen it before, so I didn't really. I had had a quick look at the synopsis on Wikipedia just to see if it was, going to be very, very difficult. But actually, it's quite a straightforward tale in many ways. There aren't any subplots, which for me works quite well because it goes straight through the story, although the story is quite strange. And I thought that the staging and the updating, on the whole, did make it quite clear, and it did make sense to set it in, well, it's set in London rather than Athens, and as you say, it's sort of all about, the bankers, and there's the, it's about overspending in a way, and the results of that, and living beyond your means, which of course is quite telling for us at the moment, and also for Greece, of course. So you can see why it's a timely piece. the word relevance does sort of hang over it rather heavily, I felt. And certain things, particularly in the second act when he's in the wilderness, when he finds the gold, which is sort of under the stage, that doesn't really fit it with a contemporary setting and jarred slightly. First act, well, so I don't know if it's first act, but up to the interval, I was sort of enjoying it because I was following it and I thought it made it very clear. The second act I found incredibly dull. Again, like you, I didn't really sympathise with Timon, and I didn't really understand why. I mean, I know he sort of turns against society and becomes a bit of a misanthrope, but I didn't really understand why he was just giving his money away at that point. And I did find, you know, really some of the lines quite difficult to get my head around. I would listen to a line and think, I don't exactly know what that means. Everybody at the end applauded wildly, I think possibly because Simon Russell Beale is so popular, and a few ovated, which I found a bit odd. But it left me quite cold, ultimately. The post-interval wilderness, as you say, it's this sort of construction site with the pillars with a steel rod sticking out of them, I thought was quite a clever nod to Greece because of all the buildings there with the steel rod sticking out of them. I assume that was deliberate. But it's actually very, very dull to look at. And I found my mind wandering and, as you say, didn't really care what was going on, whereas the first act had a sort of a flow to it. But again, at least there's no subplots, and they brought it in at the preview in just over 2.5 hours, which is quite impressive for Shakespeare.
Yeah, it's a, I mean, it was I can't really think what to say about this other than that. I've kind of run out of things to say, have you?
Well, there were other little touches that some I did like, some I didn't like. I felt in the banqueting scene, which is sort of it started as the patron of the arts, and he's obviously provided a new wing to a gallery. I thought it was very much like this, felt like the Sainsbury wing. And then there's the banquet afterwards where he's, you know, giving gifts to all his, as you say, so-called friends. But then we have a rather indulgent ballet sequence, which I would just cut that, actually. It didn't add anything, and it just made it slightly longer. I mean, it wasn't too long, but, you know, you got the gist of what he was doing without that. And that seemed a sort of a typical National Theatre extravagance, actually, which we could have done without. Because there were times where I thought, OK, I've got the gist. It just is beginning to get a bit repetitive now. I thought that Deborah Finlay's part of the steward was actually, it didn't seem to be much of a part for her. It seemed rather thankless. I liked Nick Sampson as the poet, who's one of the so-called friends. So he brought some humour to it. I thought Simon Russell Beale tried where he could to bring out his sort of rather chummy sort of persona to make him a little bit more sympathetic. But ultimately, the whole thing didn't really work for me, and I'm sort of glad I saw it, because I probably wouldn't go and see it again. And because I've got nothing to compare it to, I don't know how it stands up against other Timons. But you've seen others, so how did it stand up against others?
I think that the staging, the way they did it, brought out the worst in the play. I can remember productions. I mean, it has been some years since I saw them. First time I saw this is a rather impressive one with David Suchet and Barry Foster at the Young Vic. That was about 20 years ago, and that felt rather impressive. But that was the first time I saw it, and I think that getting to know the play more, and it just I think this showed up the weaknesses of the play. I mean, there are the fact that you don't have any subplots. You don't, you know, it is really just this one rather simple tale that he's telling, and it's almost like a morality tale in some ways. And it's rather, you know, it's a rather odd thing, an odd thing for Shakespeare to have done, you know, that kind of thing. Although some people say it's written with Webster or Middleton?
Thomas Middleton.
Yes, Middleton.
That's strange because, yeah, everywhere I've looked, it seems to say that it seems to be generally accepted it was co-written with Thomas Middleton. And yet, And it says that in the programme as well. Yeah, on the cover of the programme, it says by William Shakespeare on the sort of the frontispiece of the bit in the programme where the actual Timon of Athens programme begins. It says by William Shakespeare.
I think Shakespeare sells more than Middleton. I think.
Well, you know, yeah, but you would think they would say and Thomas Middleton because yeah. Then it would have an extra curiosity value because I hadn't known that previously until I came to see this.
Yeah.
I think that is quite interesting. I thought, well, actually, he should have written more with Thomas Middleton in a certain sense, because you can cut out all those dull subplots, which actually do, you know, delay the things. It seemed quite nice to go from the beginning of a story to an end without all that extraneous stuff going on. Although it does, as you say, he just sort of dies at the end. It peters out in a rather strange way. And we don't even, you know, it's an unusual to have a Shakespeare play where there aren't lots of people dying. I mean, I assume it's a tragedy. There's only one person dies. I suppose we're giving something away if you don't know this, but we don't really find out why he dies, and we don't see him die. He just sort of goes off stage and dies.
Yeah, whereas I've seen all 20-odd Hamlets. I've only seen three in 20 years. I've only seen three Timon of Athens, so it's not a play big on the rotation of Shakespeare, but obviously they thought it timely to do it now.
You can see why, and I think, you know, from changing it from Athens to London has a sort of a certain Olympic resonance as well at the moment. It's which I don't know if that was just coincidental, if they'd thought about that. I think it's classified as one of his problem plays, and I can see why. And yeah, there were some things about it. I thought in the general canon, it's you know the straightforward storytelling is quite good. I wouldn't rush to see it again. I'm glad I saw it, and I think if you'd never seen a Timon, this would probably be an interesting one to see. But I think the problem is for me, well, certainly for me, after the interval, I struggled to care or to want to listen, and it just seemed to drag on, and there's nothing to look at.
Yeah.
And also, because he's sort of becomes a bag person pushing his shopping trolley, I'm tempted to put shopping trolleys on the stage in the National, but with a woolly hat and his scruffy clothes, he reminded me of Compo from Last of the Summer Wine. I just couldn't get that out of my head.
I also spoke to Rev Stan about Timon. Rev Stan, what did you think of it?
I really enjoyed it. I know much has been made of it being a problem play, but I think in the context of this particular production and in the contemporary context, everything that's going on with the financial crisis, I think it resonated and made it more pertinent. I think it would be a very different play if we weren't going through a recession and global financial meltdown. I like the fact that there was a lot of symbolism about what is going on with the starting off with the play with the campsite, you know, the resonance.
The Occupy movement, yes.
Yes, the Occupy movement, the flashes of the city and the backdrop of the offices being in Canary Wharf with you've got all the big banks. And I thought it was very, very pertinent. You've got a man who is generous to the fault. He doesn't manage his money. He just wants to help everybody out. And the people who benefit from that are very driven by money. And when he needs them, they sort of run in the other direction. And I thought the idea of imprudent spending and greed came out very strongly. I don't think that would have been quite as pertinent had been watching it, say, 5 or 6 years ago before all this happened. But I think the timing for it is perfect. I couldn't understand why it was called a problem pet play until we got to the very ending. And I think the ending is a little bit strange. It's a little bit Greek tragedy in that his death happens off stage and you hear about it, and it sort of feels like a little bit of an anticlimax. I thought there was some great great speeches. I think his the change in time on in the second half when he goes having been this sort of very, very generous, very affable man to a complete misanthrope. The vitriol he blurts out. There's some great speeches in there, some great insults, and I like the sort of the character arc from that point of view. Although there was this voice at the back of my head saying, "You sort of brought this on yourself for not managing your money well enough." But I thought it was also quite dark in the fact that all the people that sort of that classed themselves as his friends were just literally interested in the money, and I thought that was quite sad. In the end, the way it sort of ended, I think you probably could have, with his death happening off stage, it sort of diminished that a little bit. And I can see there was a problem there. But overall, I thought it was a cracking production and very timely and very well chosen by the National and very well produced in terms of bringing in all the very current images and issues.
Yeah, I certainly had a problem. I've said this before, but about not really feeling that sympathetic towards him because he has been so profligate. You know, it's just that puts you off. And I think it was heightened in this production, as you say. If I think that because they so closely related to it to what has been going on recently. You get it's because they wanted to resonate with that more. They tended to you've sort of got that profligacy, and we all sort of know that part of the problem with all the financial problems we're having is that we lived in a we kind of brought it on ourselves by spending beyond our means and using too much credit and stuff like that. And it didn't really that. So you don't feel quite so much sympathy towards Simon Russell Beale's character. You just sort of think, well, you know, you should have been more careful, shouldn't you? And it did take that away from it. And not something I noticed quite so much in previous productions I'd seen that sort of thing.
But I kind of enjoyed it for that, and I thought one very sort of stark moment was when, I mean, going back to sort of the original story, and you've got like this lord that's disgruntled, and he raises the army to fight against Athens or to invade Athens, and they're all trying to appeal to Timon to sort of give them the money to sort of defend the city. But the way it was done in this production, what it was like the occupiers were basically marching, and I thought it was very pertinent when they were just these people that in our minds in a contemporary context are sort of anti-capitalist and anti this sort of extravagance and stuff, and there they were all scrabbling around for the money that he was throwing to them, and I thought that was a very dark moment, and what it says is sort of about contemporary society. That I know there was a lot of tweets when they were occupying around St. Paul's, there was a lot of tweets and a lot of comments about the fact that these people sort of were anti-capitalist, anti, you know, all of this sort of extravagance and unregulated banking. And then if you look at sort of the equipment that they've got on the phones and the mobiles and stuff, all of that is basically products of capitalism and products of free market that sort of has got us into this situation in the first place. So I thought there was a kind of nice irony there and a nice parallel. And I know that's something that you wouldn't get from a straight reading of the play without this context. I think that's something that's definitely come out of it in a modern context. And I think this is why I like this play so much, this production so much, is because it did feel like a very modern story, which is quite incredible considering it was written so long ago. It is translated very well to the current times we're in.
We're now going to talk about The Winter's Tale, which is being done by the Propeller Theatre Company, which is Edward Hall's all-male theatre group, and it's being done at the Hampstead Theatre. The play is about a man who believes his wife has committed adultery with his best friend, a king who thinks his wife has committed adultery with the best friend, and puts her on trial, sends the baby off to be exposed somewhere, The baby doesn't die, but is brought up by shepherds, and everything ends up eventually happily. It's a very odd play, and it can have some really boring bits, especially in the second half, where they have to do a sort of sheep festival, and it can be done rather badly. I thought it was done very well in this production. In fact, this production is excellent. It was a very good version of this play. I've seen it a few times, and they do it really well. And it's one of those things that's just I thought was pretty good. So, Web Cowgirl, what did you think about this play?
I always think that a good play starts with a good script. So there was an uphill climb for Propeller with The Winter's Tale, and I almost didn't go because I don't like the script. Trying to get over that, I was surprised at how moved I was by the first act. The first act really holds together very well. You're watching was it Leontes, the King of Sicily?
Yeah.
Becoming entirely irrational, and it seems completely believable the way that he slides downhill from someone who is secure and trusting to someone who sees evil in every act that his wife and his best friend do. And I thought that Propeller really convinced me of the emotional tragedy of what was going on between those people. The irrational rage of Leontes, his wife's both pride, sort of desperation, but just 100% utter belief in herself. You know, she sold me as someone who had, you know, never sinned against her husband. The way that the son, who actually doesn't talk very much, crumbles underneath the weight of everything that's going on. Even, you know, normally retainers aren't a very big part. And actually, there's a line where the retainer of Leontes, whom he tasks with killing his best friend, says, my recollection is that people who kill kings never seem to have a good ending. It was actually really very funny and kind of making us take a step back plot-wise. It's as if he'd seen too many Shakespearean plays. But when the first act was over, the person that I was with, first of all, he said, "This is a comedy?" And I said, "It's not a funny one, no." And he actually thought the play was over because it just, you know, admittedly, it seemed like the end of a chapter of Dickens with a, you know, and then they washed up on the aisle with the baby and that was the end. But it just, emotionally speaking, the play was pretty over for me, actually, at the end of that act. And I found the transition into the comic shepherd sequence so jarring. It's like I'd walked into another universe during the interval of a completely different Shakespearean play. And they did really make that sheep shearing or selling party probably the best it is possible for it to be, but it's my sincere hope that I never again see this play. That's probably the end of what I got to say, though. But you know, Nick, you're at the very same show as I was, and how did you find it?
Well, I'm also not a big fan of The Winter's Tale. I don't I don't hate it to quite the extent that you do, but this is the best Winter's Tale I've seen. And I think the very first one I saw I really enjoyed. So, but I think this, I know it's kind of too far far in the past for me to properly compare them, that this probably pips it. But since then, I've seen quite a few Winter's Tales that are that I've hated, and it's one of those Shakespeare's that I'm most likely to actually be bored in. And I do think it's it is a very, very difficult one to do because the story is so all over the place and the mood is so all over the place that productions have so much trouble getting it right. I mean, usually you kind of have this very lively bit for the pastoral scene in the second half, and then everything else ends up being suddenly this kind of really mournful, dull procession of kind of events in the jealousy story, which I mean, often I disagree about which, you know, usually for me the pastoral kind of comedy scene is the highlight, so I disagree about that, but in general, but I mean here I thought the whole thing was done as well as it can be done. It's kind of beautifully staged. It's very it's the opening couple of acts, which are the jealousy story, which, like you say, don't I mean it's not a comedy. The trouble with a lot of Shakespeare is that obviously because the First Folio had these categorizations, certain plays had to be squeezed into one category or other, and this is very much one of them that doesn't really fit in any other category, so at random the kind of people collecting the First Folio stuck it in the comedies. The first three acts are certainly not a comedy. It's done in kind of a much more straightforward style than Propeller usually do, but a very kind of intense and really, really interesting way. It really does, like you said, it draws you into this story, and you really buy it. The second half does open up the possibility to do more of their kind of signature style of the big action, the music, which is a major part of kind of their aesthetic. So yeah, the pastoral scene is really kind of it fits plays into their hands perfectly. But aside from, I went with somebody who'd never seen The Winter's Tale before again, as well. It sounds like you did as well. And I mean, he's come away from it thinking, you know, great play. So, it really can depend what productions you've seen of it, what your general impressions are of it. I thought, but there was a lot of very interesting ideas in there. Somebody mentioned already, there's quite a lot more. You see a lot more of Mamilius, who's the son who dies, and that's Ben Allen. Also, this is one of the handy things I suppose you can do with having a normal company, is he not only does he stick around a lot in the first half, kind of haunting it even after he's died, literally haunting the scene, but he then gets cast as Perdita in the second half, the character's sister. So it makes for a nice kind of through line to the whole story. And also, it kind of deals with, especially the very, very last visual of this production, deals with something that's one of the things that that really irritates me about The Winter's Tale as a play, is that once the you know, kind of part of the tragedy in the first half is that this young child dies, and then once Hermione either dies or pretends to die, depending on your interpretation, he gets forgotten. I mean, he's never mentioned again. And I thought that Ed Hall came up with a really good way of kind of keeping him in the story, and bringing to the fore the fact that, you know, there was this, you lost a child and you've not mentioned him ever since the scene where you actually found out about it. So there's a lot of very interesting ideas in this. It's a very good Winter's Tale. Yes, I mean, clearly if you're not a fan of the play, it won't convert you to the play, and it hasn't really changed my opinion about the play itself and the difficulties in staging it. But if you're going to stage it, this is as well as it can be staged. It's just a really gripping staging of it.
I think it. I think a propeller really paid my decision to go see it because Propeller was doing it paid off. And next year, next season, they're doing.
Next year, Spothnot and Taming of the Shrew next year.
Yeah, Taming of the Shrew, which is basically another Shakespeare I said I was never going to see again because it enraged me so much. And I have to say, I'm going to go see it because Propeller's doing it. And I think Propeller is one of the most, you know, outstanding companies in the UK. I would see, you know, that... I will spend the rest of my life seeing everything that they do, unless they redo Winter's Tale, in which case I'll skip that one. But it was a great production of Winter's Tale. It's just not a very good play.
This is actually the second time I've seen them do the Winter's Tale. They did it with a slightly different cast. I think Leontes played I've forgotten her name, the sort of the main critic of the woman. I think it's Chris Hands who played Leontes, but he played in the previous production. He played the why can't I remember the name of the?
Is it Paulina?
Paulina, that's it. Yeah, he played Paulina, and so it was rather an interesting change. I mean, it was they've done it, they've staged it a lot better than it was staged the first time, but he still uses similar beats, especially about Mermilla, you know, the thing about Mermilla sticking around. I do always remember the Edward Bond play Bingo, where there is a scene in which Ben Jonson says to Shakespeare, "What the hell is Winter's Tale all about?" Because it is a mess of a play. You have an entire scene which he seems not to have wanted to write. You know, the scene of everyone getting reunited, and he just decides to do that entirely reported. Off stage, and people just talking about it. Maybe because he just couldn't do it properly, or he couldn't do it justice, or whatever. But
there are people who love it, though. The play, I mean, not the production. I know people who, you know, if I say anything against it, they go, oh, "Come on, the Winter's Tale is amazing." But so it's, everything's got someone who's going to go crazy for it.
Yeah, I mean, they are always a very impressive bunch of people. These guys, they really do. You know, they seem to know how to bring Shakespeare to life. And it's only, I did find myself thinking, you know, it's such a pity that it is an all male company. If only because we've been talking in the last few weeks quite a lot on here about, you know, there not being enough roles for women and. They kind of, you know, without making women, they kind of make the women superfluous in this. I mean, they don't always. Sometimes they do, you know, sort of drag up a bit. But for the most part, their women are actually very masculine in the way they do them. They don't, you know, they don't make too much concession to femininity. I mean, there are once or twice where you get a bit of dragging up, but it's. But for the main part, you know, it's always you always know they're a man, and the clever bit is that you forget when you're watching them.
This is one of the things I really like about them is how they actually deal with the with the cross dressing, and that it except in cases where like when you've got the female sheep in here who have boobs. Apart from that, you know, there's no. Kind of chest padding and big makeup and kind of drag and it was very impressive last year in Richard III, which obviously has quite a lot of strong women in kind of impactful roles for women, and it was very apparent there how well it works having this. Because yes, you do treat them as women, but they don't play it up in any remotely kind of camp way or overdoing it, I think that of all the productions I've seen so far, because it's only these three, last year's two and this one so far this year, that I've seen from Propeller, and I think that really shows you how well judged the cross-dressing is. I mean, as Web Calco was saying, one of the plays next year is Taming of the Shrew, which is I think that's definitely, with kind of considering the reasons why that's a contentious play, that'll be interesting to see how the gender politics comes across when you play that all male.
I just can't get into the whole, oh God, you know, there's not enough women, you know, great, you know, acting in this area. When I look at Propeller, and all I care about is how fantastic they are. And you're absolutely right. I was noticing for Hermione, you know, that her entire sort of like womanliness consisted, you know, of a scarf over her head. They're just the complete opposite of Panto dames. And the only time they were really dragging it up was when the guy came on dressed as a Girl Scout, but he was actually supposed to be in disguise.
Yes.
So that actually made it, you know, even more impressive. But, you know, I have to say I am dying to see how they handle the gender politics and Taming of the Shrew, even if this might have originally been done by an all-male cast in the first place. I somehow feel that Propeller is going to really take this into the 21st century.
We're now going to talk about Mac and Mabel, which has just opened at the Vault in the Southwark Playhouse. Mac and Mabel is a musical with a book by Michael Stewart and lyrics, music and lyrics by Jerry Herman. It's about the relationship between Mac Sennett, the boss of Sennett Studios in the early silent days of film, and Mabel Normand, who was, as well as being a co-star of Charlie Chaplin, was one of his major actresses. Gareth, would you like to tell us about it? Well, about this production, sorry.
Okay, well, it takes place in the vault at Southwark Playhouse, which is a very atmospheric space, and I actually think that space suits a show that's largely taking place in film lots, so I actually think it's a good space, and it's been well designed with just kind of furniture and props at the back which come forward. Everybody calls this a difficult show, and I really don't know why. I mean, Jerry Herman, of course, had three huge hits with Hello, Dolly, Mame, and Le Cajou Folle. And everybody says this was a flop, and that this is some sort of difficult show for some reason. But it's not the first time I've seen it, but it struck me, certainly this time, as being a better show than Hello, Dolly, or Mame. Probably not Le Cajou Folle. I think that, you know, it's as good as Le Cajou Folle. And I think it's a particularly good score, even though it doesn't have kind of standards in it. But as a musical score, I think it actually works very well. I think this production is outstanding. I mean, Tom Sutherland, who directs it, has now got a remarkable pedigree, because he must have done about 12, 14 shows of incredibly high caliber here at the Landor, at the Finborough, and all sorts of other spaces. And he does a great job with this as well. And I think he's got a terrific cast, led by Laura Pitt Fulford, I think her name is, who also led his production of Parade at the same venue last year, and Norman Bowman, who I know less about. And they're both, to me, terrific. They've got great chemistry between themselves. And I thought this was a great production of what seems to me to be a good show. So I'm kind of puzzled by why it's difficult. I'm also puzzled by why the professional critics, as it were, have been more sniffy about it. And more sniffy, in all fairness, about the show than this production. But to me, it was another very good musical at Southwark Playhouse, and one I might well try and catch a second time before it ends towards the end of August, I think.
John, how did you find it?
I do think it's a difficult show, and the reason I think it's difficult is that both the historical and the book of the musical story are about pretty nasty characters, and they're set against this very upbeat, very post-MAME, bright, brassy Broadway score. And I don't think the two things fit together. If you take the character of Mac Sennett, he's a workaholic, he's pretty humourless, and he's completely unfeeling as far as what appears to be the major woman or women in his life are concerned, because he's previously been involved with Lottie Ames, the character played so wonderfully by Jessica Martin, before he meets Mabel Normand, played by Laura Pitt Pulford. And yet, so he's this dour workaholic character, yet he has to sing songs like I Want to Make the Whole World Laugh, or Every Time a Cop Falls Down, My Spirits Soar. It's just too much of a disjunct. I think it's an impossible part. And that's why I think I found Bowman less appealing than Laura Pitt Pulford, who for me was absolutely excellent. She has a tremendous, easy voice, both in the effortlessness of the way she sings and the pleasure of listening to it. I think she was pretty impeccable in the singing. He rather less so. He's good at getting the sort of tortured nature of the character, and he does have a nice warm baritone when it gets its chance. But I think one of the things I liked less about this production than I had hoped I would was the fact that the band are kept in a separate room. And I really think for a musical, particularly one where maybe it's not cast at the very, very top sort of West End level, you really do need eye contact and a directness between the musical director and most of the cast. So I'm sorry they weren't able to arrange the vault like that. It was very atmospheric, but I would have preferred this, and I'm very surprised that once they got a good advance sale, they didn't somehow juggle it, that it wasn't moved into the main house at Suffolk Playhouse, where it could have accommodated the band and possibly done a rather more grandiose production. But no, very intimate, very, very good, very good performances. I thought the choreography, when it got its chance, was a bit showboaty, but actually brilliant. And, you know, with an ensemble of only six, you really didn't get that. You know, you really felt as though he was really proud. The choreographer was absolutely filling the stage with this. The Keystone Cops chase is just brilliant.
Nick, how did you see this?
Well, one thing I'm going to disagree with straight away is about having the band not in the same part of the theatre as the audience and the actors. And I'm going to disagree for a very specific reason, which is that this is I think it's only the third musical they put on in the vault at all. It's the third one I've seen in there, and it's the first one where I've been able to hear everything everybody's been singing. Because really? I think this may be.
There was a lot of criticism about the sound mix. So maybe we didn't go on the same night. But I noticed a lot of people on press nights certainly complaining they couldn't hear every word.
That's interesting, because it's the one time I've not had any problem with it. And I mean, I kind of credited it to the fact that Tom Sutherland did Parade in there, so maybe he kind of had got used to the space a bit. Because I mean, obviously the vault has got these it's a tunnel that splits into two separate railway tunnels, which looks really impressive, and it's often used that way. And it was for Floyd Collins, it got a lot of positive. I read a lot of positive reviews about how amazing it looked and how much it suited the story of Floyd Collins. What I didn't see people say, and what I experienced, and the person I went with, and everybody on the night that I went with, said was, I didn't, you know, who the hell is Floyd Collins? I didn't hear a word he sang all night, because these two lovely, great big arches have sucked up every word he said, and it's all been drowned out by the band. So in this one, the staging is very different. It's been blocked off, those two big arches with a curtain, and then there's a bank of seating in front of it as well. And so for me, that I would rather sacrifice having the band visible if I could hear everything. But that's interesting that it doesn't seem to be everybody's experience. Certainly for me, it was by leaps and bounds the best acoustics I've had in that venue for a musical. Other than that, yes, I'm not a big fan of musicals in general. I'm certainly not a fan of kind of these quite old-fashioned musicals. So it takes quite a lot to kind of win me over, and this really did. I'm sort of halfway between the two of you about the whole thing about it being such a difficult musical. I didn't read the programme notes until after I'd seen the show, and it really didn't it was really strange, this kind of very apologetic program notes about what an impossible show it is to stage, because I hadn't seen that at all. What it is, certainly, is it's far from the greatest love story ever told, and Mac is not a sympathetic character at all. So, yes, it's not... The central relationship is not one you can get into. I think it's certainly for Norman Bowman, who played Mac, it was an uphill struggle. I mean, you know, and yes, there is a real disconnect between this person who is this workaholic, who is a workaholic obsessed with making people laugh, and you never see any evidence of it except when he specifically says, "No, this is my all I care about is making people happy." It's like, well, it's really not coming across it in any other way. But yes, apart from that, I mean, it doesn't have any standards, yes, but I found there's some really good songs in it. And it's like, yeah, they've managed to put so much good spectacle into that little space.
Yeah. Don't you, I Won't Send Roses has become a standard. Lots of people sing that outside the context of the show.
Not that I've heard they haven't, but maybe they have.
Not as much as tunes from Hello Dolly or Maine, though, really.
No, not as much as that, of course.
Yeah, I think. I mean, taking the band point, I mean, the band was hidden in Company and also in Parade. And I'm with Nick here. I actually thought the sound was better, and I heard every word. And I thought the sound was better, particularly better than Company, where I was very critical about the hidden band. And the point about the unsympathetic character, I actually thought I kind of liked the idea of the sort of the personal story sitting alongside the kind of almost the kind of history of silent movies, really. And I actually thought that worked very well. And I think maybe it flopped because in those days, you know, we weren't used to musicals that took on perhaps, you know, more. I mean, it was all chorus girls, you know, who had a break on the night because the leading lady, was ill, and almost every musical was like that.
Isn't that the story of Mac and Mabel, the unknown kid who just turns up with a sandwich and goes out of the studio a star? The parallels between 42nd Street, which is written by the same man, it's also a Michael Stewart book, and Mac and Mabel are quite strong, except 42nd Street ran for 10 years on Broadway and 4.5 at Drury Lane, whereas this never run more than 8 weeks anywhere.
Well, I prefer it to 42nd Street because I think it's more original than 42nd Street. I think that, you know, it was quite brave to write a story that had a character that was unsympathetic, that kind of was an on and off relationship. Yes, she was a girl who kind of came from nowhere, but to me, it's a musical that may be better today than it was when it first.
I agree with that, and I also like the way that Tom Sutherland got permission to tinker with the script and the plot in order to make it even darker, if you like, than it was when it was here 6 or 10 years ago. You know that the ending was changed, previous versions, I don't know if we give away spoilers, but normally Mabel just walks out on him, and in this one she dies in his arms in a very La Boheme kind of ending, which I liked much better. I thought it ratcheted it up a sort of operatic notch, really, by having such a dramatic conclusion.
Well, I've seen two productions of this show before. I saw the Watermill one, you know, the actor-musician one that turned up in the Comedy Theatre, I think, Watermill with Janine D. And I saw one in the Piccadilly Theatre before that. And to me, all three were successful in their own way. So that's why I kind of sit there thinking, what's all this about it being difficult? I've seen three good productions of this show.
It does feel to me like it's somewhere... It's maybe, like you say, it was the timing of it coming out, but because it is kind of somewhere between these kind of old-fashioned classic Broadway musicals. I mean, one thing that really struck us there is just, God, that overture never ends. Torvald and Dee must have been dancing for a very long time, skating for a very long time. But, you know, it's got a lot of... The structure of it is very old-fashioned, but there's parts of it that are... a lot more the tone of it, the darkness of it, is a lot more edging towards something more modern, like Parade, like some of the later Sondheims. So it's maybe this is the thing. Maybe it was the timing of it. It was kind of it was neither one thing nor the other.
Yeah, I think that's probably. I think maybe it's better today than it was. And it's, well, I don't know what year was it actually produced. I'm not
74.
Wow, that's a long time ago, isn't it? That would have been very unusual in its day, where we're kind of more used to, you know, a bit of dark in musicals today, if not downright black. But yeah.
It's kind of the same vintage as Chorus Line, though, isn't it? So musicals were in a state of flux at that time. It's also about a year and a half ahead of Chicago, so they're all, you know, that there was a kind of fulcrum in musical theatre that was being sort of tilted at about that time.
Yeah, but we're talking fringe theatre, you know, which has put on something to me, you know, of exceptional quality as a production. And I do think this man is very, very good.
Absolutely. Did you know that this production got a bit of extra money, rather more money than he expected, because of the man who'd been in a coma? Do you know this story?
No, I don't know that story.
There's a man called John Flynn who, when Daniel Taranto and Tom Sutherland were touting for, you know, they were trying to raise the backing for the show, they met this man who had been some kind of a businessman in the city and also a dabbler in theatre investment. But he had a heart attack and he'd been in a coma for a short while after it. And his wife and sons were trying to sort of, you know, get through to him. And they played him the soundtrack of Mac and Mabel, and his feet started to tap in the hospital bed. And when he was better and approached by the producers to do this show, he wasn't keen to pour any more money into another show until he found it was the one that had brought him back to consciousness. That's a plot of a better musical, really.
I was going to say, that's a plot altogether. Wowee.
Yeah.
But to be recommended, clear, you know. I mean, absolutely to be recommended for anybody that has any interest in musical theatre, for me.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and especially with, you know, things like Singing in the Rain doing really well at the moment. You know, I mean, I straight away, as soon as I came out of it, I was texting people who I knew had liked things like Singing in the Rain and saying, go and see this, you know, you could get in for £10. And it's there's moments of it that are even the spectacle kind of is, you know, in its own way, because it's inventive, you know. The spectacle is even quite, it really draws you in. I mean, simple things like the couple of songs that Mabel does standing on top of the steps which are being pushed around.
Yeah.
And the combination of that with the lighting, it kind of and like Singing in the Rain, you've got water coming from down from the ceiling, except in this case it's not deliberate, it's just a hole in the ceiling. But you know, that always happens in the vault. But yeah, it's certainly, I've been recommending this to people.
Yes, you can't get a ticket for £10 anymore. All the tens have long gone, so don't sell it on strength. But that's, you know, to be congratulated for that, because it's obvious.
Oh, that's interesting, because I was wondering about how it was selling, because the night I went, it wasn't that full at all. There was only only the middle bank had anybody on it.
When was that?
Wednesday night, I think. Wednesday or Thursday? Thursday night.
Because Wednesday was press night.
There you go. Yeah, Thursday night.
They had 50 bloggers in. It was it's like old home week. But
I mean, going back to Tom Sutherland, though, he does have a real knack of taking a fresh look at things. Because, I mean, last year in the same place, I mean, I really didn't like Parade when I saw it at the Donmar, I'm afraid. And I was just amazed at how he could turn around my opinion of a musical so dramatically. So he really does, for me, have a knack of taking a fresh look at things. And I just kind of almost booked out for everything he puts on, frankly, because he's a real banker for me.
Well, this is his third crack at Mac and Mabel, isn't it? He assisted. He assisted John Doyle on the Criterion production, the Watermill one, where everyone played the instruments. And then about two, 3 years ago, he did it himself at the little studio theatre in Catford, yes. Okay. So this is definitely third time lucky because he's got a good producer and a good space, and I would say it's transferable, except it's built so specifically for that space. I would only have expected it to sort of survive at Southwark. It would need quite a considerable reworking if it to make the jump across the river.
I don't think it's transfer at all.
No, I it's a shame. I hope one day someone gives him the kind of money and the kind of theatre that would allow him to stage this in a bigger format. But I don't think this production needs to make the jump.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the As Yet Unnamed London Theatre Podcast page in Facebook. On the web, we are ayu-londontheatre.org, and the podcast can also be found on iTunes, where you can leave a review. Thank you. Goodbye.